Did you know buying, selling, fixing houses, and investing in real estate is easier than you think? All you need is help from a couple of experts who flipped hundreds of houses, seen most situations, and are here to share their knowledge with you. Welcome to the Real Estate Boys radio show and podcast. Now, Andrew Jobe and J.R. Reed from PerinaProperties.com.
What's going up, Rounders? What's going up, Rounders? I already messed that up.
Yeah. It's good. We're here. Wow.
New year, and I've already muffed the first intro.
New year, same you.
Literally. How you guys doing today? We are super excited to have this show. I'm Andrew Jobe with J.R. Reed, and we've got an amazing guest today.
Yeah, we do. We have none other than Boris Sanchez from Sanmore Investments. I've got quite the introduction for this guy. So if y'all don't mind giving me a second, Boris, before we get started, if you don't mind giving me a second to give you the introduction.
Yeah.
I had to write it in my notes to get this thing right.
Is this like a love letter you wrote out last night?
This is almost a love letter when I was sitting there thinking in my bed last night, how do I introduce Boris? So introduction for Boris is the co-founder of Sanmore Investments, multifamily investor, commercial real estate investing educator, founder of the Church of Forced Appreciation, which we're going to get into later in the show, supercar enthusiast, and lastly, but certainly not least, a new dad.
Yes, yes.
Nice.
Yes, that's very much my highlight. Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate that kind introduction. Wow. All right. I'm impressed on myself. Thank you.
Enough said. Just come here and get a nice little ego boost.
Exactly. Right? Absolutely.
Yeah, man. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. We're really excited about having you. I'm really excited to have the Rounders, who are our listeners, get a chance to hear what your story is, hear what you built your company up to, hear what you're doing now to, you know, change your philosophy and get into all the nuggets along the way.
Absolutely. I'm very excited to be here. Thank you so much.
For sure. Yeah. Well, man, what got you interested or started in real estate from the very beginning?
So, I actually, in the stories that I give in my seminars and stuff like that, I really don't get a lot to do, like, my story, my long story. But I essentially come from a realtor family. I tried doing real estate back in 2005, but I didn't like it. And so I should have liked it because it was like the heyday of like what everybody was doing crazy things, right?
Dogs were getting mortgages back then.
Yeah. Yeah. I was trying to be a loan officer, but it just wasn't clicking with me. I was probably 20 years old. So I was probably too immature for that at that point. But yeah, it's something that I came back to in 2011. And then I haven't stopped since.
Cool. Very, mm-hmm. very cool. So you gave it a go in 2005 as a loan officer.
Correct. 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 I've always been, as a mortgage loan officer. But I've always been the kind of guy who's an entrepreneur, right? My first business I started when I was 7 years old. I was doing food delivery inside my own school. And
what do you mean food delivery inside your own school?
Yeah, so I was in Colombia. I'm originally Colombian. I was there until 11 years old, and it's very mountainous. So my school was in the side of a mountain, and you had the lunch room at the very top of the mountain, and my classroom was at the very bottom of it. So kids would hesitate going all the way up the mountain just to get lunch. And so one day I had the bright idea. I was like, well, what if I just charge them to go get their lunch, you know? And I did. I charged them the equivalent of like maybe 10 cents, you know what I mean? But at the point, I could get lunch with those 10 cents. I was always the one that always wanted my own thing. You know, I always kind of wanted to just not get any money from my parents. It was like, how do I get more money just not from my parents? I don't feel like begging. I was the middle kid, so it was probably like the more neglected one.
For sure.
Middle child.
And so, yeah, I had middle child syndrome. And it made me more independent, and it made me start thinking that way from a very young age. And so that's where that kind of spurred, you know. Come to find out, a lot of middle kids are entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
But yeah, that started at a young age, and I started doing that, charging kids to go up, up the mountain, come down with their lunch, until other kids started picking that up, and so I had created competition right?
You proved the market for everybody.
Yeah,
else.
I proved the market, and then I started hiring other kids to go up there for me instead, and charging slightly cheaper than everybody else was.
You were the low
charging.
Cost provider.
Yeah, I was determined to, and I was going to pay the kids like something like 30% of what I was charging in order for them to go up there, and I would just guarantee them business. Honestly, I had the whole market experience. At 7 years old, from food delivery,
the original Uber Eats of like elementary school.
That's right. That's right.
This must have been a steep hill to climb.
It is. It was. I mean, you know, it's the side of a mountain. So even for a kid, yeah, you have like all the legs in the world. But it was for, you know, it was pretty intense going all the way up there and then coming back down. It was all fun and games until the teachers found out what I was doing and then shut it all down.
Of course, the government comes in and starts to regulate
exactly.
you. And yeah.
Now I know better. I should have paid them to actually keep my business.
Exactly.
You know, that was then. I learned my lesson.
You gotta buy protection.
Yeah. So my family eventually left Colombia. And the reason we left is because, honestly, we were escaping Pablo Escobar's kind of reign of terror.
Really?
Our little school bus that we were going up and down to school on was being directly threatened. My mom was a very prominent attorney in Colombia. She had recently won some cases against the mafia. And so they knew exactly what, you know, school bus we were riding in. Obviously scared the bejesus out of my mom, and she said, nope, enough of this. I'm going to take my kids to a better place. And so, yeah, we were lucky we had family here, and so kind of emigrated and landed in Miami. And yeah, so I got to see, you know, I got to feel the whole immigrant experience because, you know, my mom was a very prominent attorney over there, but here her career doesn't get validated. And so she pretty much started sweeping floors, you know.
She had to start over.
She had to start all over from nothing because I, you know, she didn't know the language either. And so she had to get adjusted to that. And so that humbled all of us. Well, I have two brothers. And it humbled all of us and it taught us the value of what we used to have in Colombia, you know. There is a lot to be said about, you know, growing up from nothing. And then having something, making something out of yourself, but having something because we were a pretty well-off family down there. But then going to nothing, where you know you earn pesos and you're paying in dollars, it's a huge chunk of change, and so it's a problem when you're an immigrant and you're starting over and your pesos is not as worth much as the dollars, and so we pretty much, you know, went to nothing, and it humbled the kids us. And so it really brought out that entrepreneurial spirit within me. Saw my mom struggle, and so I said, "You know what? It's time to change this, and then get back to us winning as a family." And so, yeah, I started. You know, while I was going to school, I also had, you know, side businesses. I was an eBay power seller at some point. I had my own e-commerce business.
Really?
Yeah. Back in its heyday, I was just kind of like, you know, finding stuff around the house. And then it evolved to just kind of being a drop shipper back then. I don't know if you guys remember that.
I remember drop shipping.
When you used to go there and used to go to people's houses and they just sell the stuff for you. That was me. And so that grew pretty quickly. I even had my own line of pool, but like, you know, like billiards, pool cues. At some point, made in the Philippines, made out of shell, and it was
really?
Pretty awesome. Yeah,
like white labeling them, or
sorry,
like white labeling pool cues, or like you had your own brand.
Yeah, my own brand. Yeah. It was my own brand. Even to this day, if you look up, we go to eBay and you look up Boriz, the line of pool cues, you'll still find them. Those was mine until my provider just chose to cut me off and go directly to market. Whatever.
What do I need this guy for anymore?
Yeah,
you got
yeah.
the same experience as when you were doing the school lunches. The middleman got
exactly. Oh man, trust me, I could sit here all day, and you'd have a very long radio show about all the things that I've learned just being an entrepreneur and just doing things. You know, I don't think probably like foolish of me. I've never really read a lot of entrepreneurial books. I did go to school. I went to college, got a business degree. I got an MBA, but I think it was kind of sort of late because by then I had already owned multiple businesses. And so I had the aha moment. I was like, oh, that's why I saw what I saw, you know? Rather, my schoolmates were learning about these things while I was going like, oh, dang. Now I know how to make a profit and loss statement. You know what I mean? I was always trying to have my own business while I was going to school, have my own things. I even experimented with being a corporate man for a long time. I was in Shell Oil, NAIG. I have 10 years of corporate experience, all while I own stuff on the side. I owned a car dealership at one point. I owned a consulting business for car dealerships. And in 2009, I had graduated from college. I had sold my car dealership business, and I had broken up with my longtime ex-girlfriend. And so I said, you know what? I'm going to go abroad, and I'm going to go study in London. It was one of those things I wanted to do. It ended up being one of the greatest things to do, is going to over there and without even ever being in that country. I just went there, and I went to school, kind of pretty much self-sufficient, and I ran out of money pretty damn quick.
It's an expensive place.
It is a very expensive place. I went. I had sold my business for $50,000, and I thought that would carry me the entire year, but it ended up carrying me about 3 months.
Oh, you had a good time.
Wow, you enjoyed it. Had to get a job out there, had to be self-sufficient, and I did it. I got a job as a bartender. I lived in a closet pretty much in London, but ended up being one of the best things I've ever done, you know?
What made it so great?
It was the fact that I did not have anybody there for me. It was no parents, no nobody, just kind of self-sufficient. It boosted my confidence in like anything, any other business that I've ever done. It made me rely on myself, and it made me learn a lot about myself. And I think it gave me the basis for going back to real estate, like I said, in 2011, and really just going all out, you know, really choosing something and having the self-confidence enough and the self-love enough to believe in myself and that I could do things, you know. And that's great. People don't talk about that enough, I think.
For sure.
So in 2011, when you're like, I'm getting back into real estate, presumably, did you go straight to like the agent side? Did you go straight to the investing side? What was kind of your initial focus?
Sure. I actually went back to be a loan officer. And the reason I came back, okay, so I came back from London, and I was thinking I was going to stay in England and live there. But it ended up being that my brother actually convinced me to come work for the company. And I did as a loan officer. But at that point, the laws were changing because of the recession and everything like that.
Just come out of the massive Great Depression.
Yeah.
Great recession.
Yeah. And so what I did learn was a lot about real estate. And because we were doing so much brokering, we were doing commercial and residential. And I started flipping houses. And I didn't really like it a lot because I already knew some clients of mine in the commercial side that were, you know, pulling in, you know, six-figure profits just off of one deal.
Off one property.
Yeah, off of just one property. And I said, you know, enough of this. Let me try that out. And so in 2012, 2013, I bought my first commercial property. And, I've kind of done that ever since. Yeah.
What was that first property? Was it like what kind of commercial property was it?
It was, so back in 2012, 2013, I was brokering a lot of hard money loans. Nowadays, hard money is known as pretty much the flip kind of product, you know, where you borrow up to a certain amount of money of your future ARV. But back then, it was mostly used for residential flips or for cash outs. And hard money was actually known as a second chance financing tool, something that if like you were down in the hard times, you sought out hard money, right?
So they even used it as cash out?
As a cash out. Yeah, so they'll give you, for example, if you have a paid off asset or close to paid off, they'll give you 65% or, you know, 60% on the dollar of what it's worth with minimum documentation. That's honestly classical hard money.
Yeah.
And but there was this other side to hard money where you could borrow up to a certain amount of the future ARV, and that product interested me more. And so I found two fourplexes side by side. And obviously, you know, fourplexes are still kind of residential. And so I was able, I was probably one of the first in Houston to convince my lender to do hard money, that specific fix and flip hard money product, on two fourplexes that were side by side. And so essentially I bought an eightplex and I bought it for $140,000.
Wow.
And yeah, back obviously, you know, back in those days, you could do that. And using the hard money, I reserved $60,000 of rehab. You know, it was great. I was into it for $200,000. I think I brought to closing only like $10,000, which was great. I didn't know a lot, to be honest, about commercial investing. I didn't know about how it really worked. All I knew was that I did not want my asset to sit there fully rehabbed, fully done, beautiful, with furniture and everything like that, and just sit there and just kind of hope and pray that it sells. You know, and that's what I used to think that a home was like, because I experienced it. You know, I finished some homes, and I didn't get the sale quick enough, and it would just kind of sit there, and I would have to pay for staging and everything like that. It wasn't producing any cash flow.
Yeah,
that's one of the main reasons why I switched over to commercial. But with this, yeah, I knew that I wanted to do that. I bought that Aplex, and yeah, turned around, rehabbed it. And I started filling it out full of tenants. It was great. It was, you know, it was cash flowing pretty nicely. And I sought out a refinance. I was, you know, obviously exiting hard money, which was what I used to tell my clients to do. So during the refinance, I had an appraisal come to me and say, hey, your property is worth $472,000. I'm like, there's no way. There is no way. I'm into it 210. There is no way. You know, you're tripping. And I even asked some bankers about it. Some bankers, a friend of mine, they were like, hey, is this property really worth this? Some of them said yes. Some of them said no. And so I was like, okay, well, let me just, you know, get a refinance. And after we closed the refinance, I told myself, let's try it. I'm going to put the property up for sale, $450,000, and see what happens. 2 weeks after I put it on sale, I had a full price offer.
You're like, I listed it too cheap.
Yeah, I know. Nowadays, I'm like, oh, man. But before then, I was like, eureka, right?
Had the light bulb go off.
Exactly.
I'm going to make a bunch of money.
Oh, man. And yeah, sure enough, it sold for $450,000. I was able to make, you know, about a $250,000 net profit, with including rents and everything like that that I had collected by then.
Nice.
And it completely changed and rocked my world, you know.
What kind of money were you making as a loan officer at that time?
$3,000, $4,000 per file. You know, I was closing maybe 4 or 5 times a month, you know. It wasn't comparable. Even when I was flipping a house, I would make $25,000,
$35,000
after 6 months of work. But flipping one of these properties made all the sense in the world. I had no idea what I had done, to be honest. I didn't know what I did right or wrong to actually, you know, make that appreciation or liquefy that.
You just really stumbled into it almost.
I did.
You just saw accident. You saw somebody else have some success at it, and you're like, well, I don't like how my properties just sit there. My houses just sit there on the market when they're not selling and they're just draining me. So why don't I go flip something that's going to, you know, give me cash flow after I flip it?
Like, exactly. Immediately. Yeah. And that was my mind. I wanted to make $1,000 a month from my cash flow. And, you know, it was a pretty innocent, pretty conservative goal to have. And I ended up making way more than that. And, you know, I still recall me sitting there in the restaurant, you know, with the wire into my account, thinking, what the heck did I just do? And I obviously, as I started reading more into it, then, you know, obviously you should do the research before, not after, right? But I wanted to know what I did right. And that's when I started really finding out about forced appreciation and, you know, how you can, like I said, force the appreciation up from a property just because it's bringing in more money, like a business, yeah. Right? And I started really learning a lot about commercial valuations. And from then on, I was able to play around with that a lot more.
So at what point in your, like, did the light bulb go off on you that you're like, okay, I'm done being a loan officer. This is what I want to go do full time.
It was in that restaurant.
It was in that restaurant when you looked at that wire.
Yeah, I was like, yeah, I don't want to do that anymore.
Call your brother. You're like, hey brother,
yeah,
you know, like, this
hey,
job?
Man, that's cool. You know, what we're doing is cool, but I think I found a new calling.
I think I'm done.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like that scene in The Wolf of Wall Street where
show me a check and I'll quit my job right now.
Exactly, exactly. Yes, it was very much like that. After that, you know, it's not so much the money that one deal brings you, right? I mean, making $250,000 for a lot of people out there, most people, is life-changing. But for me, it was the education that brought, you know, and how it opened my eyes and how I came across it by accident. It wasn't because I had learned that somebody else did it. I just kind of came across by accident. And I wanted kind of to do that and to teach others, to get to a level where I could teach others how to do that. Because honestly, it's like I found gold, you know, or I found out how to make fire or something like that. It felt like that to me.
For sure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I, at a certain point in our investing career, I felt like that too, kind of a similar way. But for us, it was like once we figured out how to burr something, we're like, hold on, wait a second. We just bought that property, rehabbed it and refinanced it and got the majority of our money back, like almost all of it. And I was like,
yeah,
well, crap, we should do this again.
Yeah, that's fun. Yeah, it's fun. Real estate can be a lot of fun. It can also not be a lot of fun real quick, yeah. As I found out over the years. But from then on, you know, I started experimenting with 8 units, 20 units, 25 units. My first, what I call kind of big boy deal, was a 46-unit complex. That I bought in 2018 with money that I had flipped a 8-unit from.
That's and a pretty big step up.
It was pretty big. I had, in a similar situation, I had bought and sold a, I'm sorry, no, bought and refinanced, cashed out of a 8-unit complex. And I took that profit and I put it towards my 46-unit property using a bank purchase.
So when you were doing this, I just want to stop you 1 second before we get too deep in the 46 unit. Was your main idea or your main philosophy like, I want to add units and build a portfolio? Or was it, I want to, you know, flip these properties and have like cash that I'm, these big chunks of cash I'm getting from this?
Sure. Back in that day, I used to just kind of take a little bit, whatever I needed. My overhead was not high. I was a single man. I didn't have any kids. You know, I had, yeah, one of my biggest priorities was retiring my dad. And by then, I had, you know, paid off my dad's car, you know, kind of given him a lifestyle, paid off his insurance, like got a lot of headaches from him. And so I said, you know, right now I'm quote unquote young and dumb and I can play around with this idea and I can, you know, take some more risks. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to sell, but also I wanted to have as many units as possible, you know, and learn while I'm doing that. I've learned a lot since, and I, you know, just kind of spoiler alert, I'm not so sure that that is the best strategy to go. But at that point, it made sense to me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, markets change, times have changed since then, too.
Yes.
Things have changed a lot since then.
Correct.
Price points, everything.
It's so, just like personal mm-hmm. flavor. I mean, you start going down a path and you're like, this works great for me right now. This works great for me in my stage of life. Life changes, things evolve, and your strategy that you have implemented is still maybe a good strategy investing-wise, but it may not be what you want to do or what's the right fit for you at that point in time or the market conditions.
Exactly. Yeah, I think it was there was a lot of gloom and doom back in those days because everybody thought that another recession might just be right behind it. But it turns out that we had like a 12-year of nothing but growth spurt. And in the meantime, everybody was telling me, oh, you should sell. Even folks that are very prominent in real estate were telling me, oh, no, you should sell everything. you are being too aggressive. But honestly, I thought, well, my overhead isn't really that that great, and I should just keep on going and see how deep this rabbit hole goes. That's why I bought the 46 unit, and come to find out, I found more about how to finance those bigger properties, bigger than $1 million.
So I think we're going to take a quick break, and then on the backside, let's talk about how you figured out how to finance them for more than $1 million.
All right, sounds good.
Awesome.
Welcome back, Rounders. We're sitting here with Boris talking about commercial property investment, buying big units, refinancing big units. Right before the break, you were about to get us into this big project, your biggest one that you'd bought, and what you learned about financing and refinancing $1 million projects.
Yes. That property was probably one of my biggest successes. Come to, you know, obviously, I think my first one opened my eyes. The 46 unit really kind of showed me that that there is almost no limit to the creativity which you can undertake these properties on, and the breadth and width of the available loan options available for these properties. Many folks don't know, but there are many more ways to finance commercial than residential, you know, and especially multifamily, where you're bringing agencies such as Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. And that's exactly what I did. I bought this property, 46 unit, at $1.7 million. Using bank financing and like I had said, using my profit from another property, and I had reserved, I think it was like $500,000 for renovations to that 46 unit. And after doing all of that and holding it about 8 months, I refinanced using agency, which is probably one of the best terms you can get in commercial financing. It offers pretty low rates, interest-only options,
fixed for a long time, aren't they?
Yeah, it's fixed. Well, it's fixed for like 10 years.
Yeah,
but it's a 30-year amortization, and I got like 3 years of interest-only. So it's actually very accommodating for a landlord. The whole point of it is so you can kind of pass those savings along to your tenants, right?
Of course.
But along with that, what's very attractive is you can do cash outs. And in that property, I cashed out $800,000, you know. And obviously, if you know cash outs from a refinance, it's completely tax-free. You can do whatever you want to it. So I went from a bank rate to a agency rate. And my monthly payment, I think, stayed the same, even after those $800,000 of cash out, you know. And it was then that I had another eureka moment saying, oh, man, this is awesome. I could do this all day.
I just got free money.
Yeah, free money. Obviously it was great.
That's a big chunk of cash, too.
It's a very big chunk of cash, especially very liberating.
Yeah.
Very life-changing. It changed my life. But I wasn't done with the money. I actually didn't spend it all in one Ferrari. I saved it and I started investing in more. I wanted to kind of like quickly grow that and buy more property and do more like that. You know?
Yeah. So at what point did you start Sandmore Investments in this whole thing? Was this like during that time or?
Yeah. So Sandmore Investments was started in 2014 as I exited my brother's company. And I knew, you know, that I wanted to do this full time. And so that's kind of when I took off. Sandmore Investments was initially supposed to be a holdings company for my assets. It wasn't supposed to be a brokerage or anything like that. Actually, the brokerage came part because everybody kept on asking me, okay, how are you doing this? Tell me your broker some deals to me. And I was like, well, that's great. I'll just become a broker and I'll be able to, you know, have more avenues to find my own deals and find other people deals as well. And so that's how that started. I was an investor first and then a broker.
Really?
And then nowadays I'm, you know, both things.
Very cool.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're doing that. You're obviously having success doing that. And then you decide, okay, now it's time, because probably everybody's asking you, how are you doing this? How mm-hmm. are you being able to accomplish these huge feats and make these huge checks? So at what point do you say, okay, I'm going to start an education business?
Yeah, it was kind of like hand to side to side. Actually, my first student, it was at that 46 unit. I actually moved my office to that 46 unit because obviously I needed all my attention. It was a big boy deal. And so I had, you know, I had my assistant there. And then I a couple of friends asked to join me. And so my company was growing. I had maybe 6 employees at the office there in one of the units at one point, and including, you know, brought students and everything like that. And that was maybe 2017, 2018, something like that. Yeah. And yeah, that's when the whole Church of Forced Appreciation started happening. By the way, that's an endearing term. It's not something that's actually, you know, it's something that my students actually started naming it, because I just sit there and talk forced appreciation all day long. It's like I'm preaching forced appreciation, right? Because I don't think people talk about it enough. When you look at the whole kind of like options of what to invest in as assets, there are only very few assets that you can force appreciate. You can buy stocks in McDonald's. But if you go work at McDonald's, it's not going to do anything to your stock portfolio.
Not at all.
You know? Same thing with Bitcoin. Same thing with, you know, the other things that you can invest in. But the great thing, one of the great things about commercial real estate is that you can go to work on your actual asset and increase the value of that property just because it's bringing more income.
Yeah.
Right?
Just increase the income.
Exactly. You can't do that in residential real estate. People say, well, you can do that in residential real estate. You can't. What you're experiencing is more organic appreciation. Sure, you can beautify the kitchen, the bathrooms, and everything like that. But if it's not bringing enough money or income from that property, you really can't value it as in a cash flow value. So hence, it's not really bringing about forced appreciation. Yeah.
Especially these days, there's no way you can, in most markets, value a single family house on a cash flow.
Exactly. Yeah, they won't. Valuation. You know, it's. I don't think Fannie Mae even allows that in their appraisals to count in cash flow as part of a home of a home's value. But they absolutely can in a commercial property. Commercial being in apartments, 5+ units, and so. Yeah, that's where I kind of went off the tangent and started only buying properties that could force appreciate.
For sure.
Mm-hmm.
And so you were all in on forced appreciation, all in on, you know, this is the best way to do this. This is the best way to invest, grow my assets as many as I can, get as many units as I can. The one thing that you do differently than a lot of people is you don't believe – or at least you didn't believe. You used to say, I don't believe in doing syndications.
Yeah.
Can we talk about that real quick?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So because of the way I've always kind of been self-taught, whether, you know, that's for good or bad, that's the way I was taught, self-taught. I just always thought, look, I think people start investing in syndications, and syndications being, you know, part of a group that you can invest in. You put your money in, at least $25,000, $50,000 in, and they'll promise you a return, you know, based on, you know, how the cash flow looks for that certain apartment complex or whatever you're investing in, right? You're investing in a group, basically crowdfunding.
Yep.
But I always thought, look, that's because people don't really know the strategies behind acquiring commercial real estate, including the loans that are available out there. You know, there are so many hybrid loans, the SCR loans, there's private individual, there's institutionalized hard money lenders, there's some banks, obviously. So there's a lot that folks might not know out there. And I started being very creative with that. So as long as you're being creative in your strategies and acquisition strategies, you know, rehabbing strategies, in your sales strategies, just creativeness overall in real estate is really what brings about the possibility of you doing it all yourself. And so I'm like, okay, I've made big checks, you know, I've made really big checks from commercial real estate. Folks in the syndication world, yeah, you don't have to spend any time doing it, but you're probably just going to go in there for a flat return. And with the hope that one day the syndicator actually sells the asset and then maybe you can make one or two times your investment, you know? But I was making it many times my investment. In a lot of cases, I was going in, if you notice, in the first deal that I kind of described, I went into it with only $10,000 out of my pocket, and I ended up making $250,000.
Yeah, 25 times.
Yeah, 25 times my investment. And so I said, look, people don't talk about, you know, how to multiply your initial investment enough. People only talk about returns. And for 99% of people out there, we don't have the liquidity. We're not multimillionaires enough so we can put our money to play and live or create wealth from a simple return. We have to put it into an investment that produces your initial investment many times over. And that's how you create wealth. That's really how you create wealth, not from simple returns. And so it led me to kind of keep going down this mentality of like, look, forced appreciation creates wealth. Cash flow only maintains it. You know, if you're making a simple return of, call it 10%, which is a very, very good return, you're only kind of maintaining your current level of wealth. Or if you're putting an investment in and it's going to multiply that many times over, you are actually creating wealth. And that's what folks need to focus on. Yes, there is risk. There's risk in everything. There's risk in creating a simple return. But I think there is really no risk in actually educating yourself in assets that can multiply your initial investment. And then make your decision from there. Once you're educated enough in all the different investment avenues and strategies, then you can make your mind up to, okay, do I want a simple return? Maybe I don't have the time. Maybe I'm an engineer with a career. I don't have the time to actually tinker around with these properties. Or I do have the time. I just have to put in the effort and multiply my investment over and over, hereby creating wealth.
For sure. But you have to have the... You know, it sounds great and it sounds very easy, but you have to have some real cojones to put, because that 25 or that, let's say that $10,000 that you brought to the table to do that, you know, you're on the hook for that 250 that you borrowed or the 200 that you borrowed to do that.
Yeah.
And I think people are always worried. They're like, well, what if I lose it? How do I pay that back? And all this other thing. It's never that you're going to lose it. I mean, as long as you manage it correctly, you can do it and you can manage the risk that's there. And people are always like, oh, I don't know if I could, you know, wager $10,000 to make 250. Like, I feel like I'd be losing too much because I'm borrowing 200K. And I think that's what keeps a lot of people out of that. That absolutely. And they just don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, I think I saw somewhere that even if you said you save up to $10,000, say you save up to $100,000, right? Yeah. And it's your life savings. You've worked corporate world forever. You've saved up to $100,000. And you put it to work on, let's say, the stock market. I think the average return is like 8%.
Yeah.
That's annual. You're talking about $8,000. You're talking about less than $1,000 a month on just cash flow. Who can survive on that? Nobody, you know? And so you're certainly not creating any wealth or maintaining your current level of wealth, because honestly, between taxes, between life, bills, and everything, it's just gone. And so why not educate yourself about something that can bring about $1 million, not just $8,000, you know? Something that's going to at least multiply your initial investment a few times over. And so there is greater risk, I think, in leaving out knowledge that can bring about in the multiplication of your emotional investment. So why not just learn about some other things that can get you there? I think many people just dismiss it because they fear what they don't know and they try to make excuses about, well, that's with the big boys, you know? So many times I've heard in my life, well, commercial real estate, that's just for the big boys. That's not for, you know, peasants like me, which I've heard so many times over, and that's just so wrong.
For sure.
You know? There's a greater risk in becoming or being ignorant than being educated. And so all I'm asking for, you know, the rounders out there today is like, look, I challenge yourself to just learn a little bit more about commercial real estate. I challenge folks to just kind of open up your mind saying you can do this. You know, you may be comfortable in maybe investing in residential, but why not give at least the chance to yourself to learn something else more deeply into real estate, and maybe you'll take a chance. Maybe, you know, just like any investment that you make, you can risk up to a certain amount. I wouldn't bet your house on it, right? But maybe you can find yourself with enough money that you can say, okay, I'm going to put this to work and I'll see what comes out of it and see what the lessons I learned are.
I couldn't agree with you more on the fact that you don't get wealthy on getting a simple return, a 10% mm-hmm. or a 15 or 20, even a 20% return. It takes you still a long time at that.
Correct.
To become wealthy. And you do have to figure out a way to create wealth out of nothing or out mm-hmm. of very little, where you can multiply your investment.
Correct.
And that's how everybody gets wealthy. If you look at, I mean, just anybody that is wealthy in this world and they created their own wealth, or they're self-made, they built a business, they created equity in a business, they created equity in investments like you're talking about in commercial assets, where they took a distressed asset and turned it into something that's a beautiful asset that's cash flowing. There's all kinds of different ways, but you have to create that equity somehow, some way, whether it's forced appreciation like you're talking about, whether it's building your portfolio and building equity up from buying discounted properties and putting those together. Somehow, some way, you have to create equity out of pretty much nothing.
Yes. That's why a lot of people choose to start a business, you know, is because they want to create something from their own, you know, hard work and some elbow grease, you know. I believe a lot of folks start businesses and they may call themselves successful, but at the end of the day, they're waking up at 4 in the morning, they're going to sleep at 9 p.m., they don't have a boss, but they're the slave of responsibility, you know.
They have 10 times the responsibility as a W-2
exactly.
employee does.
And so a lot of folks, you know, say, okay, I'm a business owner, but then really look at your lifestyle, you know, versus an employee. You're probably working twice as hard. Why not invest it in some assets that sure are have a lot of similarities to owning a business, but at the same time, you can experience that forced appreciation. There's James Toter back there. That's a great, good guy. So you can experience that forced appreciation from an asset unlike you've ever seen. And that's without even starting to talk about the tax savings that, you know, these commercial properties can bring about. That's really the quote unquote, you know, magic pill behind not paying any taxes, is because a lot of these investors actually have commercial assets that they're depreciating. And all those quote unquote losses are going against your wins, your capital gains, thereby completely eliminating your tax liability.
Yeah. That's the thing that people don't really know about. And that's where the big win, I feel like, is for a lot of real estate investors and a lot of wealthy people. Wealthy people don't really pay taxes like W-2 income earners do. The people who pay the most taxes in this country are high earning in W-2 income earners.
Mm-hmm.
They pay crazy amounts of taxes. And, you know, in real estate, we get to depreciate our assets against our income.
Right. Exactly.
So it eliminates the income tax.
Yeah, a lot of people, you know, say, oh, I don't pay taxes. I haven't paid taxes in a long time. But that's not really what they mean. What they mean, as folks like me, is like, look, for the past 8-9 years, I have completely eliminated my tax liability, my federal tax liability. I don't pay any taxes because, honestly, I don't have to, because I don't have the liability anymore. And these assets have provided me with all the depreciation needed in order to do that. That's another huge plus of why to invest in hard assets like this.
For sure.
Yeah.
I love that. Man, okay. We only have, you know, let's call it 6 minutes left in the show.
Mm-hmm.
So at what point in your career did you kind of shift your mind? Because there's a lot that's happened in the last couple of years in commercial real estate. And I think that there's been a big shift from what I can see in your mindset of how to invest properly, at least for you.
Yes, there has. Obviously, there's no secret. Commercial real estate has not done well in the past couple of years. That's because of a myriad of reasons why it hasn't been done. Obviously, the biggest one would be rates. Back when I was trying to get off the ground and experiment a lot with these type of assets, we had a maybe 4 to 5% interest rate. Back in 2020, it got really sweet when COVID happened and the rates dropped to like almost nothing.
But that's when prices got out of control.
That's exactly, yeah. So prices had been building up for some time because people, as more people found out, hey, these properties are really not like a dirty asset. Back in the day, commercial properties used to be thought about of like dirty assets. Like, ooh, what do you own that?
Class C apartments?
Class C apartments. Like, ooh, Jesus. It was only thought of a way that you can just get out of it, or like it was an avenue to get out so you can invest in the stock market. It's like, ugh, sell that so you can invest your money in the stock market like everybody else. Come on, you know?
But all the smart guys are.
Exactly. And now it's a little more sexy than that. It's a little more acceptable than that to actually be a commercial real estate investor. And so, yeah, as that became more popular, prices became more expensive. At the same time, things were happening, such as insurance was getting more expensive. Taxes are just getting more aggressive. The taxing authorities are getting more aggressive into valuations. Sellers are not selling for what they used to. And so it was slowly squeezing a lot of profit out of, or a lot of potential forced appreciation out of a project, right? You had to really buy smart. Of course, just like everything, you have to look enough. You know, you have to dig when you have to really dig when you're actually trying to find gold. And when everybody's doing it, you have to dig even more. So we were buying still properties at the height of it, 2019. And we were buying properties in 2020 when everybody thought the world was ending. But it really wasn't until the rates started kicking up and insurance really started ticking up that, you know, it really started to put a strain on commercial real estate. And I found it really hard to actually start and buy right, because I always say you make your money when you buy, not when you sell. 100%. Right? When you buy that property and you buy it right, you know for a fact you're going to make money. And so you're really making money when you buy. And so it was really getting hard to do that, especially with the rising costs and cooling rents, you know. And so I said, you know, I think I need a new strategy. And I've always kind of been a contrarian. I've always kind of said very surprising things, you know. And my strategies haven't always been the most popular. But when people were syndicating, I was saying, nah, you know, buy your own stuff. You can do it. You can do it yourself. People were buying homes. I was like, nah, invest in commercial real estate. It's actually more riskier to invest in residential than it is in commercial, to say those things back then. I still sort of believe it. But yes, so I started back in, a couple of years back, I said, I think I need a new strategy because it is really getting hard to go from my strategy of hard money into a long-term loan and pay my monthly payment at a comfortable enough level where it creates equity, right? Not to get too technical, but everything in commercial real estate comes down to the numbers. Do the numbers fit? That cash out of $800,000 that I told you guys about, would it fit right now with the monthly payment that, you know, that I was paying and with the income that I was getting from the property? It doesn't. The DSCR, the debt service coverage ratio, started, you know, getting tighter and tighter to the point that cash outs are pretty much eliminated. I haven't had a cash out in a couple of years, at least.
And you don't hear about these big cash outs anymore.
No, yeah, forget it. That's a thing of the past. At least, you know, for now, I don't think they're going to be in the horizon for at least another 1 or 2 years. And so I said, okay, well, there's got to be a way to invest in this and strategically enough to for it to make sense. And what I came across was the idea, the kind of horrible idea that people don't like to talk about, which is owning commercial property outright with no debt. So yes, it is very cash intensive, but I've been lucky enough to actually build up my cash reserves enough to, or my equity enough, so I'm able to sell some property and buy other property just cash.
Just own it cash.
Just own it cash.
And just appreciate and enjoy the cash flow.
Enjoy the cash flow. Enjoy the benefits that it also brings. And to talk real quick, I know, but we're running out of time. But the other benefits of owning paid off commercial real estate is the fact that, you know, the insurance savings that, the insurance minimum that you must get that, that lenders require you to have is no longer there. So you kind of get a little more, you know, breathing room with insurance. Another thing, is, which is a most people don't know, is that the taxing authority, including HCAT, Harris County, they when you don't disclose what you bought the property for, they will look at the deed of trust to see what your loan amount was, and they go based on that.
Oh,
you know?
Wow, what a hack!
Yeah, and so
I hate to cut you off here, but we're running out of time.
I got it. No worries.
I'm sorry. If you want to learn more about Boris, you need to get in contact with them. What's the best way for them to get in contact with you?
Please email me, boris@sanmore.com. I'd love to hear from you.
Yeah. And you, Instagram?
Instagram at bsanmore1. Yeah.
bsanmore1. Boris, we loved having you on the show, man. Thank you so much for coming on. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, JR. Appreciate it. Thank you, Andrew.